Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Remember when you couldn't watch movies streaming directly into the comfort of your own home? When you actually had to make a real effort to watch the latest hit movies by heading to your local video store and renting a movie? Maybe you supported your local independent video store, but chances are pretty good that sometimes you had to make it a Blockbuster night. You may think that Blockbuster Video went out of business years ago, and you'd be right, 2010 to be exact, but there is still one remaining Blockbuster Video store in Bend, Oregon. Director Taylor Morden and writer Zeke Kam joined forces to create the documentary The Last Blockbuster. Taylor explains the doc's origin story.
The first thing that popped into my head as a filmmaker was, oh my God, what is going on here? How are they still in business? Who is still renting DVDs in 2016? And so very quickly reached out to the manager and the owner of the store and said, would it be okay if I started bringing a camera around here? And they were like, I don't know why anybody would want to do that, but okay.
Yeah. Zeke, were you a big Blockbuster fan growing up?
I'm like 10 years older than Taylor. So in my hometown, when I was in my prime movie watching, I don't know that Blockbuster had started yet. And there certainly wasn't a Blockbuster in my town. So there was one video store. It was huge. And that's where we got all our movies from. So by the time Blockbusters were everywhere, I think the first Blockbuster I saw was when I moved to Los Angeles.
Taylor, the first Blockbuster store opened in Dallas, Texas in 1985, and other locations soon followed. What was Blockbuster doing differently from the other video rental stores that allowed it to have this fairly relatively quick expansion?
Well, you know, we get into that in the movie, and people can see that story, but there was, you know, they had some interesting software that put them ahead of everybody else. This was very early in the computer age. And so the fact that they even had computers running their systems, this was, other stores were still using pencil and paper to say, you know, Zeke checked out a movie, we'll make sure we get it back. They did that. But when RevShare hit, I think their partnership with all the big studios is what made Blockbuster take off way faster than everybody else.
Yeah. And RevShare, Rev stands for revenue, right? Can you tell us a bit about how the revenue sharing worked?
Yeah, most video stores would have to buy their movies just like everybody else, one at a time. And at the time, videos cost $100, $120. And so they would buy one or two copies and then rent them over and over and over again to make their money back. But what happened with RevShare, with Blockbuster, Hollywood Video, and a few of the other big chains, was the studios, your Universal, your Warner Brothers, Paramount, they had a deal in place where they would basically give them the movies for little to no money and split the profits from the rentals. So Blockbuster could get 100 copies of The Matrix, and they weren't paying, you know, $150 each. They were paying a dollar each.
Yeah, it was like between $1.50 and $5, I think.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And the mom and pop stores couldn't get those deals. You know, they were still paying full price. So that's really the unfair advantage.
Let's talk a bit about the movie studios. Rightfully so, I guess, viewed video rental stores as an existential threat. What did Hollywood try to do to protect itself?
Lawyers. They sued. They sued everybody. They sued they sued the people making the VHS tapes, like the blanks, like Sony. Mm-hmm. And they sued the video stores. Mm-hmm. And they, by doing that, the grand jury actually came down with a decision that it helped them in the long run, but I think they thought it was going to put them out of business at first. I think the studios thought when they lost this court case, they were going to go out of business.
But then just a few years later, it was the number one source of revenue for most of these studios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then, the thing they fought so hard against.
Tell us a bit about Sandy Harding, alias the Blockbuster mom, because she's pretty much the star of your film, I think it's safe to say.
As the Blockbuster mom, you know, I'm always walking around reminding them that I'm really not their mother, so I don't really need to clean up after them.
She's just the greatest lady. If you didn't fall in love with her watching the film, then we failed.
Well, yeah. No, I did fall in love with her, so obviously you succeeded.
Well, it's not that hard to make people fall in love with Sandy. She's just so nice, so caring, so thoughtful. My favorite moment from making this film is after we pretty much finished. We didn't have the final cut of the film, but we were pretty much done. We finished shooting and everything. And we were trying to find a distributor, and we didn't know what was going to happen because all the film festivals were closing because of COVID. And she said to both of us, if you guys need work, you can always work here at the store.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn that Sandy often has to go to local stores in Bend, Oregon to buy the latest new releases. Why?
Tuesday mornings are our new release day. And so every Tuesday morning, I have to look through and see what movies that we still need to get that we didn't get through our vendor. And then I literally go around to Walmart and Target and Best Buy and anywhere else I can try to find movies and buy what we need.
It's because the distributors have mostly gone out of business. And now with COVID, I think the last couple of distributors she was working with are gone now too. So it used to be she would have to get about half of her movies at Target and Walmart and wherever you and I would buy movies. But now it's everything. She has to get every movie that comes out on Tuesday morning at like 6 a.m. before Blockbuster opens. She has to go and get as many copies as she can, which isn't even that many copies because they know her at Target and at Walmart. They know, oh, she's buying for Blockbuster. So they limit her to 5 copies.
Oh, yeah.
So she has to go to Walmart here in Bend and Target here in Bend and then drive to the next town over and go to Walmart if she needs 20 copies.
Right. She doesn't take a lot of vacations. She's a really hard worker. But she was on a short vacation in I don't remember which city, but some city. And she told her husband, pull in over there at the Target. And he's like, why? And she said, they'll have more copies and they don't know me and I can buy a whole bunch.
Oh, yeah, she won't be limited. Yeah, she's crafty. That's Sandy Harding. Yeah. The comedian, actor, writer Jamie Kennedy is one of the talking heads in your film. And he had this interesting story that he told about working as a member of the Blockbuster entertainment team. Can you tell us a bit about this, Taylor?
We reached out to Jamie Kennedy because of his role in Scream, because he played the video store clerk.
What's that werewolf movie with E.T.'s mom in it?
The Howling, horror, straight ahead.
We thought, oh, it's great. He's going to, you know, he had to research for that role. So he's going to have all this insight. We had no idea about his first job, you know, as an actor, his first paying gig being for Blockbuster Video. He sprung that on us. And you see that moment in the movie where he's like,
I know, you had no idea I was going to drop that gem on you, did you?
We didn't. We were super surprised and it was great. But that's kind of his sense of humor. You know, he had a prank show. He's like this notorious prankster. So he was reluctant, you know, he was playing games with us like, oh, I don't know if I want to be in your movie and I don't really have much to offer for a Blockbuster story. And we thought for sure on the day of the interview, there was a good 50% chance he wasn't going to show up. And little did we know, we were being lured into a ruse of sorts where he knew he had that fun story to drop on us. But yeah, he worked for Blockbuster Video for a couple of years in the early 90s, him and Jim Gaffigan and a couple of female actors that they don't seem to remember the names of that well, but they were the Blockbuster entertainment team and they were like the human mascots for Blockbuster Video.
So as human mascots, what did they do? Did they hang out? They didn't hang out in the stores. Did they like, you know, Disneyland characters or what did they do?
They would go on like on a world tour is what the way he described it, like going to all the different stores to grand openings,
okay.
You know, like ribbon cutting ceremonies.
TV commercials, promotions.
Oh, okay. Zeke, tell us about one of the big historic moments in Blockbuster's history was when Sumner Redstone of Viacom bought Blockbuster for $8.4 billion in 1994. What impact did this have on Blockbuster?
I think at first it helped them expand, but as you saw in the movie, he decided to use it as an ATM machine. And started leveraging against it kind of as a sacrificial cow. And ultimately, it put them in a very, very difficult position as a chain.
In 2000, Blockbuster was seeing competition from Redbox, Netflix, on-demand movies, and the DVR. Is it true that Blockbuster had the chance to buy Netflix, but they didn't?
Yeah, so the story goes that Netflix somehow got a meeting with the Blockbuster executives, and at the time Netflix was this brand new startup with their DVDs in the mail system that was just starting to catch on, and they got this meeting with Blockbuster, and they came in and they told them, we've got this idea, this plan, this system, and we've got this startup company, and you guys have the infrastructure and the name Blockbuster. Why don't you buy us out and we'll merge and we'll do DVDs by mail, and you know, you can have all of Netflix at the time for $50 million, which was no money to Blockbuster, and looking back would have been the best bargain in the history of entertainment. And the Blockbuster executives, thinking that they knew better than everybody else in the world, just laughed them out of the room. And then, you know, Netflix went on to become Netflix, and Blockbuster went on to, well, not become Netflix.
Right.
To become exactly. Our movie.
Yeah.
you have this very interesting scene in which you're telling comedian Doug Benson to talk about a bit about Netflix setting up this meeting with Blockbuster, and then to offer his thoughts about what might have happened in that meeting. And he has this very funny line that I'm not going to spoil here. But why? I was just fascinated that you would include this behind the scenes footage. And you do that. You did that on a couple occasions.
So who set up the meeting?
I believe Reed Hastings. Some Netflix set up a meeting with Blockbuster early on.
Yeah.
And if you could start by saying something like that, and then speculating on what you think happened in that meeting.
Okay. So the story goes.
Why did you choose to do that?
Well, Taylor and I, when we started out, we were like, let's make this an upbeat, funny documentary. Those are our favorite documentaries to watch, and this world needs some uplifting. So let's do that. And I think it was our editor, Tim, who it was his idea to put it to kind of make us characters in the film, very, very small characters in the film. And when we saw that, we were just like, wow, it really humanizes the whole thing. And since Blockbuster is such a physical entity, like when you remember it, you remember the physical things, the touching and the tactileness of it all. And I felt like that really added sort of a tactile, the illusion of a tactile feel of us, of our fingers actually, the filmmaker's fingers in the film.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I love that you did it. It almost kind of seemed like, hey, are these guys making this documentary live? We're watching the streaming of them shooting it. What was Blockbuster's plan to fight off this competition that they were experiencing from Netflix and Redbox?
They copied the DVDs by mail from Netflix, and they also copied Redbox's kiosks. But Redbox had beat them to the market and had secured all the good locations, all the grocery stores and convenience stores. So Blockbuster's genius idea for their vending machines that had movies in them was to put them in the locations they already had, which is the parking lot of a Blockbuster video, which makes, to me, no sense at all. If you're at Blockbuster, just go in and get the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there was something else they did, because I think like that we you haven't mentioned yet, which is just the one idea that seems like, you know, like why they would go ahead with it, you know, could be summed up in four words.
At the time, it was the customer's number one complaint was late fees. Everybody hated late fees. And, you know, Antiaco had this idea that, well, we'll just take away the thing everybody hates. And he didn't really think it through. I think he did not think it through to the logical outcome, which is nobody brought their movies back. So they had no movies on the shelves. And people would complain, you know, instead of late fees, the number one complaint became, why don't you have any copies of any movies on your shelves?
You have this great montage at the end of your film where you give each of the talking heads a video cassette. Can you tell us a bit about this montage?
Yeah, it came from us. Just we made that videotape just to film. It's at the beginning of the movie, just as a physical representation of our movie. We thought, oh, that'd be fun. We'll make the VHS way ahead of finishing the movie, and it'll be a funny thing that exists. But when we held it in our hands, it was just so striking. It had probably been 20 years since I had really held a VHS tape and appreciated the weight of it. And then, just like everybody in the movie we handed it to, I opened and closed it for that plastic clicking sound and, you know, take the tape out and look at it and do all that and smell it and just listen and feel. It's such a tactile thing, and that's very hard to convey in a movie. So we used all our celebrity guests as sort of proxies for us, for remembering what that meant for a movie to be a physical object. And it's very hard to convey. Ironically, now our movie is out primarily on digital streaming platforms where people rent it. And we get tweets all the time, oh my God, I rented it on Amazon. How ironic. So it felt very important to really ground it in that, yeah, movies used to be an object and this is what it felt like and sounded like, and there's weight to it. And we couldn't think of a better way to convey that than to be like, here, Adam Brody, hold this for a second.
Yeah.
And every time you did, you know, they, all those wheels would turn in their brains, just like they did for us, of, you know, they're struck immediately by the weight and the sound and the feel of it, without fail. Every single person we handed it to was just like, oh, taken back 20 years instantly.
I actually got like a little up through my spine just then when I opened the box. Kids don't have this magic anymore.
But this sound, oh, it's so satisfying. And then that one, you just make sure that it's closed.
Absolutely. It's a very powerful and poignant moment in the film. So there wasn't really a copy of The Last Blockbuster in the video, because in the cassette, in the case, because you hadn't finished making it. And obviously because VHS is an obsolete medium, there are no plans to release it on video, right?
That tape was a copy of, I think, Pulp Fiction from Pacific Video that we put a fake label over. But now I have taped over it, and that same one that they're holding now does have a copy of our movie on it, because VCRs can do that kind of magic. And also, we are releasing this movie on VHS for the limited edition VHS run on blue and yellow plastic VHS tapes.
Really? You are doing that?
You bet.
All right. That's very cool. That's very cool. Taylor Morden and Zeke Kam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
Zeke Kam is the writer and Taylor Morden is the director of the documentary The Last Blockbuster. Find out more about Zeke, Taylor, and Blockbuster at WPR.org/beta. And remember, please be kind. Rewind.
I felt a great deal of responsibility. I felt a lot of apprehension about if I would mess it up.
Writer and editor Brandi Jensen talks about her popular advice column. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.